Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Hassan with another episode of The Influence Continuum. And I've been wanting to get my next guest on a recording for a really long time. I'm so delighted to do this recording because we have a medical doctor, an expert on hypnosis, someone I know professionally from my own involvement with the New England Society of Clinical Hypnosis, where my guest served as president. She was also president of the Society of Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis. So we have Elvira Lang Anderson, MD, PhD, with us for the positive side of the influence continuum, talking all about the healthy ethical uses that caregivers and the medical system can understand how to help patients, clients, lower their anxiety and stress and help their body's natural healing to be employed. I'm going to just read some more laudatories, Elvira, if you don't mind. You're an award-winning interventional radiologist. You've been researching the effectiveness and cost savings of rapid hypnotic techniques in medicine and dentistry. And you have crystallized these techniques and founded Comfort Talk, which is a registered trademark. You've done large-scale clinical trials with over 135,000 patients, demonstrating that Comfort Talk skills, including guidance and self-hypnotic relaxation, a reduction of pain, anxiety, drug use, and complications on the operating table, which can improve patient satisfaction and ability to complete MRI examinations. I recently had one, so I know how noisy and scary it is. I had one on my ankle. Your recent interests examine patient-provider interactions about their impact on health outcomes, staff satisfaction, resilience. You've won awards, the Ernest R. Hilgard Award for Scientific Excellence for a lifetime of published experimental works, and need to plug a book that I've been giving to my dentists and doctors since it came out, Elvira, explaining things like you don't tell the patient this is going to be painful. Like, that is going to elicit an expectation set of pain, as opposed to this will be fast and smooth. You'll explain more. But if you are a medical professional, this is a very fast, wonderful read. And for the rest of us, managing your medical experience, the information you need, and self-hypnotic tips for finding comfort with your tests and treatment. So with that, Elvira Lang Anderson, welcome to the Influence Continuum.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure and delight and actually honor to be with you. I've admired your work all these years. You really opened my eyes to how people can use hypnosis in powerful but possibly for the affected individual, not most positive way.
Well, yeah, I'd say mind-controlling them, Elvira, and
yes,
changing their personalities and giving them a dissociative disorder and phobias and all kinds of other stuff. But I want this talk, I want to just give you the floor to explain, and I'm hoping doctors and nurses and therapists especially will be listening to your wisdom and will be interested in getting trained beyond reading the books by you and your work. So please.
Thank you very much. It's very kind. You know, if we look at both of the work we focus on, I think there is one commonality that in the interaction between individuals, the relationship and the suggestibility of the individual both count. And while this sometimes can be, how shall we say, abused by one of the individuals, what we see in the medical context is that in this very unequal situation, you know, there's your healthcare professional and the SU, that a lot of what people say in healthcare is said out of the very, very best intentions. But since it everything that can be misunderstood will be misunderstood, there are sometimes some undesirable outcomes. And so we've been working a lot on how can we help people in healthcare to find the right words. Often it is just little tweaks in what they say for then having a positive impact. And where things though get pretty complex in healthcare is there are often cultures of understanding. If you believe that what you do hurts and you feel obliged, you have to warn this person it's going to hurt, and then you do your needle stick and it hurts because, you know, the suggestion creates the expectations and it hurts, the person is justified in what they said. I mean, it did hurt.
Right.
Yeah, and it keeps hurting more and more. And so it is very difficult to bring upon a change because it is a serious belief of the individual that they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I've experienced as a patient who knows hypnotherapy, knows this stuff, and the dentist is like, this is really going to hurt. And I'm like, excuse me, can we have a redo? You're going to say, I'm going to do this smoothly and efficiently with the words of comfort talk. Can you do that over again? Or otherwise, I have to literally do like an erasure of what just came into my ears, you know, seriously. And then I send them your book. And I'm like,
oh, thank you.
Learn. I mean, I have a box of your books because I feel like this is something I've learned. I've learned hypnosis since 1980, and it really matters. There is a nocebo effect. We know placebo effect, this pill's going to make you feel better. Nocebo effect is this is going to hurt, and this is really bad. And we are embodied minds. I did an interview with Lawrence Sugarman about his work, you know, his work as a pediatrician. So I keep experiencing it myself. So I'm trying but this is why I wanted to interview for my podcast, because we can reach people around the world immediately. So please continue.
Well, interestingly enough, we came to have to do a clinical trial on this whole issue of what providers say to the patient when we did a study on large core breast biopsy. So for that procedure, the women lie on the table, there's an opening in the table, the breast goes through, and then it is, well, basically squished into the equipment. And if you were to give IV drugs where somebody always can stop breathing, you wouldn't be able to turn a patient around quickly enough to give them breath. So therefore, you have to do everything with local anesthetic. And for that study, we had to do a video of all the interactions because NIH wanted to make sure that we can always demonstrate that the people who were supposed to do the hypnosis did it. And so our poor research assistant who was doing a hypnosis script got interrupted every 5 seconds by somebody telling it's going to hurt and sting and burn. Until the patient actually, there was one video where the patient actually finally believed it, who said the whole time, no, it doesn't. And then suddenly, oh, but you know, now it's like as if you're cutting the flesh out of my skin. And God. Then the doctor said, well, there's nothing there. You're just imagining it, yeah. So we showed it to them. They still didn't believe us that that was a bad thing to do, to talk like that to the patients. So we did a clinical trial where we told people you can say whatever you want during the cases, but we looked at the tapes and we checked when these statements were used, even when it was said little pain, because it's the negative implication, it's right. Going to hurt. And we could clearly show patients had significantly more pain when you use these statements and more anxiety. if you wanted to be nice afterwards and said that wasn't all that bad, for the subsequent stimulus, it still did increase more the anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had this ammunition to show it's not a good idea to do.
Yeah. And it only makes common sense. If you say to somebody, this procedure is going to hurt, it creates, in social psychology terms, a frame of hurt. So your mind is scanning for pain versus think of a beautiful field with flowers, your favorite place. While we do this simple routine procedure, and know that we're going to take the best care. I mean, I'm riffing. I've never been in the room with you as you're teaching clinicians. Why don't you share a little bit more of what you're teaching people to say that will aid in the reduction of discomfort and pain?
Well, one thing to keep in mind that the people in these kind of jobs don't have time for that many sentences.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So what we say to always include, and actually I also use that when I have to go to the doctor or so, I say, use only the suggestions that are helpful for you and the rest let go by. Because that's a beautiful immunization for whatever sounds may be coming up. Use all the sounds and noises to deepen your own experience. Sometimes that's all you need to say to someone because, again, they're highly suggestible. And people tell you, oh, you know what? Actually, that MRI, it sounds like that clunking stove back home. That feels comfy. Or one who was a jazz musician. Oh, you know, it's just like being in a concert.
Mm-hmm.
So often people use that to do their own imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you give the stimulus, you can be just descriptive. I'm giving you the numbing medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or you can go a step further and say, well, some people feel some warm or cold or a delicious sense of tingling, which is a little bit confusional because nobody exactly knows what that is.
Right. And delicious is a mouth thing, not a body in, an aesthetic thing.
Delicious sense of tingling. And
yeah.
So by that time, you already have given your injection or your immunization.
Right.
And you have been truthful because you don't know how it's going to be.
Right.
It may be warm, it may be cool, it may be that. I don't know. So, but where actually the delicious sense of tingling can be used too is, And I learned that trick from one of the technologists we once trained.
Mm-hmm.
She had to get a vein procedure on her leg. And for that, you give many times local anesthetic along the entire leg. And the doctor was convinced it's going to hurt. So he says to her, okay, it's going to hurt. And she said, "What? Like I usually say, no, only if you want it to. No, I know it's going to hurt. Just gonna hurt."
And oh, said, God almighty, that poor woman.
She said, and then he said it a third time, and I looked at him, and she said to him, "No, not for me. For me, it is a delicious sense of tingling," which made him shut up right away. And I've used that too for one of my dentists. You use that sentence on the person who does that to you, they think you're crazy, they shut up, they let you in peace. So you can assure your own medical peace.
Yep. And I love that, you know, we in the field are always learning from our patients and from people that we're training, right? Because human minds are amazing. And I just want for my listeners who are new to the field of hypnosis and suggestions to just highlight that what you were saying was an open-ended suggestion. Use whatever things I say that will be helpful, and you can ignore the rest. So you're giving permission to the person. If they hear something in the background, don't pay attention to it, right? So you're giving authority to the person to control their own experience, to make it more beneficial, smoother, and more comfortable. Did I get it right?
Right. I mean, in the, and again, also that came from the clinical trials we did, where we had to show what people actually did or didn't do in the different groups.
Yes.
And giving the perception of control is a very important element.
Yes.
Because if, you know, just look at the medical situation, you know, MRIs, outpatient surgery or whatever, perhaps even not as much dentistry, but a lot in the other medical piece. If you had to design an experiment that would maximally elicit old trauma. And what we learn through this work is that abuse and trauma is very common. And it comes out in this situation. If you were to design an experiment where you take somebody's clothes off, like your gown, you take the clothes off, you put them in a position where they're not allowed to move, and whatever you do, even if it's just diagnostic, it's going to affect possibly their life or well-being. You couldn't design an experiment better to get old trauma out. And so you have to know that the people, let's say, who are claustrophobic, it is trauma.
Yes.
The advantage, though, is you see the person in the trauma. All you need to do is reframe the experience. That if you do this whole, you know, people do exposure therapy.
Yes.
Let's see, particularly in veterans. If you do that in your office, and I admire the people who can do that, like you train to do all that kind of deeper psychological interactions. But there you have to get the patients back into the trauma. You have to convert it and you have to get them perfectly fine again by the time they leave. And you have 45 minutes to do that.
I don't do that, by the way, with want people to re-experience old trauma. But go ahead.
I think for exposure therapy, you know, EMDR, whatever, if you want to reframe it, you have to get there somehow.
That's why I don't like EMDR.
Right. So the debut and... You know, there are some people in hypnosis societies of the old ones, oh, you know, frontline people shouldn't be doing anything psychological with these patients. Well, heck, I mean, you got to deal with that every day. And our criteria for success are not zero pain, zero anxiety, but can I get the patient on the table, keep them on the table, and be able to do what I need to do with dignity? These are the criteria.
Right.
If you can do that, your patient's going to be extremely proud. And I know at least of one case when MRI technologist cured 11-year-old PTSD of an abused individual.
Fascinating.
Minutes.
They didn't come in for it, but they got that benefit because the technologist knew this was an opportunity to help.
Well, and he had to get the patient through.
Right.
So, you know, it is, and that's something I am more and more fascinated by. It's a dyad. I mean, you're in there together. You are going to rub off from each other. And so we did a clinical study where we looked at what happens with people who come in with greater anxiety or the ones who have a negative affect. Oh, for me, everything always goes wrong. Well, they're right. They have significantly more adverse events.
Yeah.
Their cases take longer and they get a lot more drugs. So it's a very interesting interaction among people. And we look a lot of team training. I just came back of a congress in France from the European Burn Association.
Oh, burn is like one of the highest pain, medical conditions of all, right?
Right. And I think what is often underestimated is the people who do the procedures afraid too. I mean, we're afraid of hurting people. If I do surgeries, I mean, you're afraid to kill somebody.
Yes.
I mean, not intentionally, but you always are afraid too. And so in a team, you only need one person to be stressed out and stress rubs up on everybody else. So if you look under standard of care, pain goes up over time, regardless of amount of drugs given and invasiveness of the procedure. We found that. But if right at the beginning you change something, we call it comfort talk, whatever, doesn't
comfort take talk is great minutes. Words. I think we should use it, and it's your trademark, term. So I think that's great. So continue, please.
Yeah, if you do that, that increase doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, if you're in hour number one or number two or three in a case, it makes, on an awake patient, it makes a big difference.
Yep.
For everyone. The other good news is in these teams, you only need to relax one person, and that also rubs off.
Mm. So a contagion effect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember back here in the business with Deaconess, medical teams. Our manager said, we are Boston's best dysfunctional family. Yeah. You together all the time, your days, your nights, you know, tempers flown. And when it got too stressful, she would say, okay, somebody go in there and read that script to the patient. So we work with script a lot for a variety of reasons. So it's the rub-off effect.
Yeah. So what, you know, just again, because my listeners have been listening to me some for 2 years, we're embodied minds, and our minds filter perceptual experiences, including somatic sensations. And so we really have a lot of power over our experience. And if I may share briefly, like 17 years ago, I came back from a workshop in Australia. I had a golf ball in my left armpit. It wound up needing surgery. I saw a clinical hypnosis person. You may remember Max Shapiro. May he rest in peace.
Yes.
And he gave me a trance, and we recorded it. I put it on an iPod. And he said, when you have this procedure, it's going to go smoothly, efficiently, minimal blood flow, and everyone's going to be amazed at how fast you recover. I'll never forget it, because I'm listening to it as they're wheeling me into the surgery. So I have the procedure. They're like, oh my goodness, that was great. So easy. My doctor said, go see the physical therapist, in 2 weeks or whatever. I went and see the physical therapist. The physical therapist said, raise your arm. I went like that. She said, no, the other arm. I went like that. She said, now, which arm did you have the surgery on? I was like, this arm. She said, can you move this, forward and back? And there? She said, you don't need physical therapy. It was like, yes, it works. And throughout my chemo and my radiations, I would see Max weekly. He would do a session. He helped me with sleep because I would wake up with anxiety and stress. We know we need sleep for our immune system. I was fighting cancer. And thank God it hasn't come back. It's 17 years. But I have a personal experience with the power of this approach that is just, the medical system needs to know more about this mind-body connection. That's why I'm so thrilled that you've done the clinical studies. You can show the data. This is not hypothetical. It's not woo-woo. And I believe hypnotherapy can cure a lot of the opioid epidemic where people are having pain. They could be taught, this is my belief, but people can be taught how to dial down their pain. you know, if the physical, I mean, pain is our signal that something's wrong, but sometimes it gets stuck. There's nothing wrong, but we're still feeling pains. Anyway, this is your interview, not mine, but forgive me, but I'm so excited at your work. It's just so groundbreaking and important.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I thank you for sharing that. It's just really great to hear how all those elements interact. And it also shows for your listeners, hey, yes, we get hypnosis for ourselves too.
Yeah, I don't do hypnotherapy on my clients professionally because I want them to trust me and I don't want them wondering if I'm, but I talk therapeutically in the sense that I am orienting my words, not towards increasing trauma, but towards a future them that's healed and teaching them the tools, how to reprocess, do self-hypnotic healing techniques to reclaim their power, to recover from undue influence. So that's what I've chosen in terms of my professional work with this.
Well, I think a part of that is, and we see that with the training, is after a while, the kind of the way you speak, it's sometimes just small changes, but it does become second nature. And so what we had seen, I mean, we train teams, so we see very long-lasting effects. We train the team, but we tell them, you can use it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you still see over time where you have the sustained effects, let's say, on patient satisfaction particularly, and throughput. And let's face it, I mean, no hospital, no clinical institution is going to hire you unless they get a financial benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
Or a throughput issue.
Right.
Unless perhaps in some medical systems where people really believe in the better outcomes of patients, where they have to achieve the maximum benefit with a set amount of resources.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say Canada, Netherlands, we work a fair amount in the Netherlands, actually also the VA system, yeah, and the VA system sometimes gets a bad rap, but there's a lot of very good work done. That's where we actually started our work, by the way. The VA was the first that funded our work,
mm-hmm.
yeah, where we first started to look into all of that. So, you know, there are all these variable aspects to it in how something is perpetuated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let me give you an example. In the Netherlands,
which is where you're from, for people wondering about your accent.
No. I'm from Germany.
I apologize then.
I'm studying Dutch, yeah.
Okay, I apologize.
my Dutch tutor would be delighted that you said that. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the correction.
I will tell her.
Okay.
But so in the Netherlands, the breast cancer screening is free. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly well organized. Mm-hmm. Every woman, you know, above a certain age gets a letter every year to come for the exam. If you live somewhere where there's no mammogram, they drive you a truck there.
Wow.
So it's as easy made as possible. But only 65% of women would come because they believe it hurts.
Mm.
Or wouldn't return again. I mean, U.S. return rate for mammograms, 85, 90%.
Mm.
So we did a pilot there. We were training. And so then two interesting things happened.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind, the entire patient interaction is 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
From the moment the patient's picked up at reception, walked to the changing room, get the mammogram,
yep,
walk out of the changing room and out the door.
Wow.
That's a total of 6 minutes.
Wow.
So they work in caravans. The work's pretty stressful, as you can imagine. Yeah. And so they had a very high turnover. So two things happened. After the training, the women expressed that it hurt less. But the morale went up because something magical happened. The patients said, thank you. Occasionally. And particularly now with COVID, for many healthcare places, there is a big issue. You know, we lost a lot of staff through COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, many died.
Yeah.
Just died.
Mm.
Then you have now fewer people having to do more work, with the institutions having lost a lot of money through it, so they want you to do even more work than there was before.
Right.
Then you have a public that's very polarized. And it really dawned on me, we did a training in Spokane, Washington State, where you have the most mild-mannered people who love nature, who really, if anywhere, in tune more with the environment and all. And you have this huge sign in front of the hospital that says, aggressive behavior will not be tolerated.
Mm.
You know, this wasn't New York.
Right.
Where it would be normal. But so you have the people in healthcare who meet an aggressive public where nobody wants to do the work anymore.
Hmm.
Applications to nursing schools have gone down 30% the last year.
Hmm.
Because if somebody goes to nursing, typically they know another nurse or related to one and ask him, hey, what do you think? And now they're being told, forget it, don't do it. Yeah.
Right.
So we see that it's now a big incentive for the whole comfort talk, that if you know how to talk to a patient to diffuse tension quickly and convert that situation into a pleasant one and feel you made a difference, and perhaps they even say thank you, or at least not nicely, you're willing to come back the next day.
Yeah, positive reinforcement from the patient to the technician and the clinicians. It makes perfect sense.
It's a two-way street, you know?
Yes. And a lot of people go into healthcare because they care and they want to help people. So there's a higher pain rate if there is pain or a bad result, that the provider feels it because they care.
Right.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. Can I shift to your advice for people for them to navigate their medical experience, please?
Absolutely.
So help, because so many people, they just need to understand more about what's within their control, what's within their power. You know, getting second opinions is just like, it's a no-brainer for people who understand the system. But for a lot of people, they just take the first choice, or they go with the doctor in their system that is available instead of waiting 2 months for someone maybe who is more highly trained. I don't know. Please share your wisdom with my listeners.
Well, I think patients probably have more powers. And so I think just going into the setting, I will only listen to suggestions that are helpful for me, and the rest I just let go by to kind of just ground you.
To say this to yourself.
Oh, yeah, to yourself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To just ground oneself. And in the interaction, you know, we have in the book a fair number of the rapport skills we have staff use on patients.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of tell the patients also to use that on the staff. We did put an app together, the Comfort Talk Pro app, which originally we did for the people we were training in hypnotic language,
mm-hmm.
that they could listen. But then they told us, hey, we're taking that when we go to the doctor ourselves. And so with the pandemic coming, we basically first made it free for the VA. Now it's free for anyhow Comfort Talk Pro, either in the Apple Store or Google Store for free download.
It's you have an app? I didn't realize that.
Oh, Comfort Talk Pro.
I have to download it immediately.
Yeah.
Comfort Talk Pro.
Yeah. Sorry. It's just very simple, very fast. We actually did test it at Tufts Dental School in the Craniofacial Pain Center in a setting where we knew people go there because they have pain, number one. Number two, it's the dental waiting room where you hear all these drills going on. So and where you don't know how long you are in the waiting room. Because see this increase in pain and anxiety over time, that happens the moment you step in there.
Yes.
Yeah. And may not even be pain where you come for. I mean, it's like where you sit on your back, your whatever.
Right.
So, and we show that with this short listening between whatever, five minutes and 10 minutes, people did have significantly less pain and anxiety. So if you get into then your patient, doctor, or caregiver interview, and you're not as stressed out, they don't get as stressed out, so you may get a bit of better information too.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but we focus just on four elements. The one, just the quick relaxation. The other one, confidence.
Mm.
Because if you want to know if you're going to keep the doctor and what you want to do, it's better you get your own confidence up. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also great for falling asleep at night. Oh, man, the dreams you're having when you do that one. Really awesome. And then one for pain management and one for anxiety management. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, NIH allows us to market for anxiety management, interestingly enough. And then we have a few addenda, and you mentioned that before, the whole issue with bleeding, yeah? And I learned a very nice variation on the theme by Rebecca Johnston.
Oh, I love Rebecca.
To say, it will bleed only as much as needed.
Yes.
Because what happened, and that's important for the listeners. When you use hypnotic language, you have to be incredibly specific.
Mm-hmm.
So she said she had a dental procedure, and one of our other trusted hypnosis friends did a hypnotic induction for her that it will not bleed.
Yeah, not good.
So later, when she had a blood draw, and she has good veins, they couldn't draw any blood.
Oh, my goodness.
So she realized, okay, one has to, you know, reframe that suggestion, but also just use a very permissive idea. It will only bleed as much as need to be. And so we also use sometimes in one of the suggestions for pain management, a little mantra, strong, numb, courageous, and safe, and numb only for as long and where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because see, we work in MRI, and you know, you don't want people to knock their knees together where it can get very hot and not noticing it or things like that. So you have to be extremely, extremely specific.
Yeah. So for those who haven't had an MRI, and I have because I had cancer, you're in on this platform, this table, you are rolled into this big machine, and it's so noisy, and it's clanging, and it's, you know, claustrophobic-esque if you have a tendency to that. So it is the opposite of comfortable and relaxing. So I wish I had access to your work before, you know, I had that, but because I'm trained, I was redirecting my mind away from what I was out of my control. I mean, the only control was hitting the button and ending the test, which I needed. So I just, you know, did things with my mind to distract myself till it was over. And furthermore, whenever I get a vaccine, and this may be cheating in terms of hypnotherapy, but whenever the stick is about to happen, I pinch my thigh.
Yeah.
My attention goes to my thigh. I don't feel the arm at all. But I've done it to myself, and I know what it was. So it just is a beautiful way to have painless injections.
Well, we teach that too. You know?
I bet.
Reversion to a different body part.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't the mind wonderful?
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible. And our healthcare system, just there's too much pharmacology from my point of view, too much, you know, technology without appreciating we're human beings, we're embodied minds. And that therapeutic alliance or that relationship is one of the most important indicators for a successful outcome.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And what I love about your work is that you did the science, you did the studies, the clinical trials. This is not hypothetical. Anyone listening to this, this is not woo-woo. If you want woo-woo, go on the internet to untrained mental health professionals who are going to do hypnosis. And you're walking, in my opinion, into danger because you don't know what their agendas are. But when you're with licensed healthcare professionals who are properly trained, you have a much higher chance of having a very ethical professional experience. And so what can we do to get more of your work implemented around the world other than me interviewing you? What else can we do?
Well, we train. We have a very well-established, clinically tested approach to it. And I think that's also, you know, what we typically recommend, you know, whenever anybody introduces any of these methods in their clinical environment. Mm-hmm. In a way, we were fortunate, even though at the time I was upset about it. Mm-hmm. How could NIH ask us that? They asked us, how do you control for the empathy of the provider in the interaction? Mm-hmm. Now, if you run a clinical team and you think you would be rating the people who work for you by their level of empathy, that's like suicidal. Mm. Yeah, you would not do that.
Right.
So we thought, okay, let's start and define some behaviors. Mm-hmm. That we do find essential. And then would you go back to look, well, gee, what do you need to do good hypnosis? Just look, what did Milton Erickson do? Mm-hmm. And Bandler and Grinder obviously, you know, examined him and asked, what was he doing? What made his charisma?
Yeah, that's the NLP folks, for those who don't know the names. Folks.
And, you know, they did get into some, you know, discredit because, of attempted use in using the techniques to get themselves absolved from some murderous activities.
Well, that was Richard Bandler. And also, I think the eye movement patterns were never confirmed that they were teaching. Tell me.
Well, there was a nice little article by, I think it was a Korean researcher who worked with David Spiegel, who looked at the whole eye movement piece and the interaction with the brain.
Well, the eye roll is a very famous hypnotic susceptibility test, right?
Well, I can get in the eye thing a bit too, because and there's a reason.
Please.
Why we teach, and I'll tell you a story about it.
Great.
So what we did is we just took 8 behaviors. You know, like giving perception of control, avoiding negative suggestions, and then some of the rapport skills, mm-hmm. and then reading the script, mm-hmm. so that you can watch the video and look on it, do people do it or not. And so we defined a control group where people could do whatever they wanted, mm-hmm. except doing hypnosis, an empathy group where we call that empathic attention, mm-hmm. you use those skills, and then the hypnosis group where you added the script. Mm-hmm. So what that helped us to do is that we knew exactly which set of behaviors produces which outcomes. Mm-hmm. And then over time, you can, you know, do variations. But if you keep the training in these behaviors in the staff, then you can add new outcomes in different settings. Mm-hmm. So that was level one of our first 3 prospective randomized trials, over 700 patients. Mm-hmm. And you know, thanks to NIH and DOD and actually part of the VA, that was possible. Mm-hmm. So then came the next step. And that happened after I had shown, you know, this all works, but how do you get the message out? So I had to set up the company. Mm-hmm. because it did get somewhat awkward when you work at Harvard and you start training people at Tufts and Boston Medical Center and all the others. So I got out of the academic piece, set up the company, and then we got Small Business Innovation and Research by NIH to test. Imagine you can get a grant from NIH, Small Business, to check hypnosis and teaching in it. So that's what we got. And we were able to validate a training module that would produce these outcomes. You know, could say, okay, if you do these 8 hours of this training, well, 8 hours online and then this, then that's what the staff does.
Yeah.
And then we had to get to the next level. How do you develop trainers that can bring that forward? So in the settings where we train in an institution, or like in the country, like the Bevölkerungsuntersuchung, you have to develop their own trainers. I mean, we can't do it all. But the idea is to give it to the next generation.
Right.
So that's kind of a model that we evolved. I'm sure there are others. But if anybody's interested in their setting, yeah, just go on the website, see what we do. And
the website is comforttalk.com.
.com.
Okay.
You know, there's short courses, then you can do the longer course. And then if you want to get your institution trained, we'll work on something.
So we'll do a blog based on this interview. We'll embed the video so people can come to freedomofmind.com and read the blog, get those links and such. We need a revolution in healthcare. We just do. And we know so much more now about neuroscience. We know so much more now about the mind-body connection. And this approach is so vital, in my opinion, for how my thing is, it's your mind, only you should control it. And in order to control your mind, you also need to have a screen. If someone's trying to do a hypnotic programming suggestion, like putting a phobia in your mind in order to get you to go to a course or something, you need to be able to go, oh, that's a phobia, not interested, run in the other direction. So just for protection, people need to understand how the mind can get hacked by smiling, happy people who are so confident and certain that they're going to fix you. And then you wind up believing in QAnon or space aliens or some other conspiracy theory that has no grounding in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so when I have one quick little about the eyes.
Please.
We use it for the simple reason to avoid misunderstandings. And the band like Winner thing is eye movements, is that we typically have different sensory preferences. Some people are more visual, some are more auditory, some are more kinesthetically oriented.
Yep.
And the idea is that the auditorily people, they tend to move their eyes right and left.
Laterally, yeah.
The eyes to the left if one thinks of something. So if you want to think, what did you eat last night? The eyes may go up to the left or go somewhere
to
the left.
Remembered memory versus constructed memories.
Versus what do I want to cook tomorrow goes to the right. So whereas some people draw some wrong conclusions is that if you look to the right, it doesn't mean that you want to prepare something that you lie about it.
Right.
What's more important, and we had one example in one of the two nurses that worked with me in the training who were reasonably good friends. And so when I told them that people who are auditorily anchored and you tell them something, they will look to the side. But that means they listen to you particularly well. And the one said, now I get it. I always thought she doesn't trust me or doesn't look at me and looks away.
So false interpretation of body cues.
False interpretation that they don't care. And we are a culture where people like to look each other into the eye. Yeah. That's not in all cultures the same. And desire. So if they don't look back. Or I recall we were going to hire a new secretary in the hospital, and the person who came, very kinesthetically anchored, kept looking down. I mean, this, if you go for a job interview, that's a stressful situation with an unequal power relationship.
Yeah.
And she always looked down, very kinesthetically oriented. Several people in my group said, nah, she can never talk to the patients when they come. Fortunately, that the manager and I, we agreed she was really, really good. And it turned out, sure, when she had a job, it was fine. But in that moment where she got stressed, she would look down. And if people do that, let's say who take an exam, have a job interview, and they do that, the other person thinks, oh, they're looking down because they have something to hide.
Right.
You're not honest.
Yep. Yep. So with situational induced anxiety is different than real life. And people need to have understandings that if you're if you're interviewing someone for a position, it isn't how they do on a test or on the interview. It's how they'll perform in real life.
And also remember for the people who get interviewed to realize, hey, I gotta think of that. I gotta get my confidence up.
Yeah. So and rehearse and such. That's very helpful. I also remember right hand dominant have reversed from left hand dominant. I don't know if that's true, but educate me if you know differently.
Not something I've been looking too much into.
Yeah. So to summarize, we have patient sedation without medication, a beautiful short book. We have managing your medical experience, the information you need. Now we know there's Comfort Talk Pro app that people can download, and they can go to comforttalk.com if they're interested in training or if they are part of a healthcare institution and want to have everybody trained. And we really have a crisis in healthcare, and providers and doctors and nurses are getting burned out, and because they're being forced to work harder than they really should and do more. So we really need to have a culture change, I think, especially in the U.S. And people should really appreciate their healthcare providers more. How gifted and blessed we are to have access to modern technology and such. I mean, I had a cancer that was deadly. And now with the development since I got it, I think they have a new treatment for Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so it's a miracle, really, that we now have such deep understanding about mind-body and body mechanisms and such. Any last words?
No, well, just thank you so much. I very much appreciate being with you. I mean, you've been one of my heroes for the work you do.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot to me.
It's very, very important, to work at that part, because we are at such a risk, you know, with social media, with whatever else is going on, to upend the way we enjoy our daily lives.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I did. I have another podcast that talks about how social media is hypnotic. The way doom scrolling and et cetera is putting people in altered states of consciousness where their critical faculties are offline and people are losing time, which is a feature of trance states. And people just need to reclaim their mind and their body and their values and what's important to them, and not become controlled by the technology. I have to. So, Elvira Lang Anderson, thank you so much, and let's stay in touch.
Great, Stephen Hassett, thank you.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, bye.
That's it for today's episode of The Influence Continuum. I've been your host, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Theme music for the podcast is by Nasser Malik. To keep up to date with me and happenings that I think are important, please visit my website at freedomofmind.com. There you'll find in-depth articles about cults, mind control, and other relevant topics. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at cultexpert. If you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of these topics, I highly recommend my books, Combating Cult Mind Control, Freedom of Mind, and The Cult of Trump, in that order. These books are a culmination of 45 plus years of experience and will really help you grasp the complex web of undue influence. I have also launched a new 9-hour online course for anyone interested in a deep dive into issues related to recovering from undue influence in all forms. While this course is designed for clinicians, everyone can benefit. Remember, love is stronger than mind control. And thanks for listening.